Religious exemptions for vaccinations. STDs on the rise. And what happens if you're on Medicaid and you get cancer? Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU, online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We're going to look at three topics today in a health-related program. In our first segment, we're going to call in Michael Gormley. Michael covers Albany for Newsday, and if you follow the news, you probably know that the New York State Legislature recently voted to end the religious exemption for vaccinations. Now, almost as soon as it was passed, Governor Andrew Cuomo signed it into law. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Always good to be here.
Always appreciate your time. Tell us about the debate. What did you see and hear in the weeks leading up to the vote?
Well, you know, this is one of those issues that the opposition kind of snuck up on Albany. It wasn't a huge number of people. It was a very vocal number of people. You can't easily say that they were evangelicals, which can have a pretty strong voice here in New York State, because the evangelicals were split on this as well. So it was some subset of the evangelical Christians and some Orthodox Jews who felt that they didn't want government telling them that their children had to be vaccinated for measles and other diseases, and they pointed to information. I hesitate to call them facts, but because they weren't really verified, but information on the internet that these vaccinations could pose a problem to children. So it became one of the loudest confrontations we've had in Albany. Again, not a large number of people, but very vocal, very committed, very passionate about this. And the argument that most of the legislators used was that they found no religion that opposed vaccines. So they said they used that for the reason to eliminate the religious exemption for denying or for refusing to have your child vaccinated.
How many people actually do you think showed up to protest?
Well, I think we maybe had 30 or 40, but keep in mind that does represent, you know, more people than could actually come to Albany during the week. But, you know, that's kind of small for a group, for an issue here in Albany. The difference they had was that for some reason, they were able to get into the gallery of the assembly, which is above the assembly. So when the assembly was voting on this and ultimately approved it, there was a lot of shouting, and the people had to actually be taken from the gallery by state police, and two of the legislators who supported their position had to go up there and help escort them out of the chamber. So it was quite an event, although the votes were pretty overwhelming.
Is the gallery normally open to the public?
You know, it's open to the public, but they usually don't let people go in there who have signs, who are clearly there as protesters. This is quite a tourist attraction, the Capitol. It's a beautiful old building. So that's usually the people who go to the gallery, invited guests who are going to be honored with a proclamation or tourists. But in this case, they ended up putting a lot of the people that were anti-vaccinations up there.
They were escorted out, but they weren't arrested, were they?
There were no arrests in this one. No, and that's not an uncommon thing in Albany, and it's not as big a thing as it might seem on TV, because arrests here are fairly common in demonstrations. People decide who's going to get arrested. Police work with them very closely, and it's to make a point. But it's not as serious a deal as it might look like on TV footage.
Have you seen such contentiousness in Albany in the past, like you witnessed here with this?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that this was the issue, of course, was vaccinations. But for the people who were protesting, for them, it was they didn't want government interfering with how they parent. That becomes a much more central issue to people. Some felt that it was about religion, but many didn't really have a religious bent on this. They were just using the religious exemption because the medical exemption, which is the other way to avoid a vaccination for your child, is very difficult to get. So they would go to the religious exemption, which was much easier. So, again, even in the subset of people opposed to vaccinations, not all of them were citing religious differences. And, of course, anytime someone's faith is questioned or they feel that it's being trampled upon, it creates a real problem.
Sure. And I remember, and I believe it was in your column that I read it, I don't have it in front of me, some of the protesters were saying, it's my child, it's my job, and I have the final say. Don't tell me what to do.
Right. And again, that you can understand that, right? You can understand that sentiment anyway. The problem is that the legislators and the vote actually, some of the votes came closer than what they probably were in reality, because once it was clear, and it was clear early on, that the religious exemption is going to be eliminated, there were several legislators who voted against the bill because they didn't want to be seen as voting against religious rights. It's that sensitive an issue. And against parental rights, which is maybe even more sensitive to a lot of people.
Sure.
So it became a bigger fight than what the bill was about. Although we have seen an uptick in measles in New York State, and that's a concern because of this idea of a herd immunity.
Mm-hmm.
If 95% of people in a community have an immunization, then the herd or the whole group, say the school, is considered protected. But once it gets below that, it becomes more dicey, and it was moving towards that lower level.
Michael, does this go into effect immediately? I know in the case of driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, there are reports that it's going to be delayed because of lawsuits. Is the same thing possibly going to happen with this?
It's possible, but, you know, it's like Governor Pataki used to say, this is New York, everybody sues over everything. and it is true, almost every bill gets some kind of lawsuit. That doesn't necessarily slow it down. There has to be some kind of, a judge has to see some kind of a possibility of a constitutional question being raised. So there'll be lawsuits. The more realistic delay in this is New York State's process of creating rules that put into place legislation. I mean, it's all kind of arcane stuff, but this can take, you know, a month, 3 months to do rules. On this one, though, I think you're going to see it come fairly quickly, because basically what they have to do is to eliminate an option that's already out there in legislation and in forms that are provided to parents.
Okay. Now, Michael, just to be clear, the state can't force anyone to be vaccinated. Isn't that correct?
Very, very good point. This is not forcing anyone to be vaccinated. It's vaccinated. It's saying that they can't go to school. They can't go to school events if they're not vaccinated.
So then what are the parents left with? Homeschooling?
Some are left with homeschooling. Others are trying to find some other ways to fight this, to bring their kids in. We're going to be watching very closely in September when school opens up, because the people who are angry at the passage of this bill are still angry, maybe angrier.
Yeah, I'm curious to see whether or not they'll simply pull the kids out of school, or if those who are really opposed end up moving to states that still have the religious exemption.
It's possible, but that would they might be advised against that, because this is not just a kind of a lefty New York idea. This is an idea that's a concern in an awful lot of states. More, you know, red states even are showing this concern because it becomes a public health concern.
Mm. Michael, what are you hearing? I mean, is the fight over in the legislature? I know we talked a little bit about lawsuits, and what Governor Pataki says was true for many states. Is it over in the legislature? Is there any way that this can be reviewed or come up again?
I don't think you're going to see it come back up. And part of that is the way state government in Albany is set up. You would really need the governor, the head of the Senate, which is Andrea Stewart Cousins from Yonkers, and the head of the Assembly, which is Speaker Carl Hastie from the Bronx. The three of them would have to agree to bring that issue back, and they're not going to do that. Even a groundswell from the legislators, which I would even doubt would exist, probably couldn't bring it back. Once they shut this door, they shut it pretty hard.
And I noticed that Governor Cuomo signed that bill lickety-split, huh?
Yes, and that was probably a smart thing. It avoided another confrontation, but it also shows you how much people, progressive legislators, or at least Democrats, want to be associated with this decision, how popular it is among Democrats. The governor could have not signed that for quite a while, but he wouldn't have been part of that story. So that was a move that we see the governor make when he wants to make sure he's part of the result. And in fairness, he was part of the negotiations that led to this. I mean, it was a three-way negotiation.
I'm curious to see what Connecticut's going to do in the future. They did nothing with the religious exemption in this past session, and nowadays I find that Connecticut looks at New York, looks at New Jersey, and the three of them are kind of watching what the other one does on some major issues, and I'll be curious to see how Connecticut reacts to this over the next year or two.
That's a good observation. We've noticed that too here in New York, that we're hearing, you know, Connecticut did this first, New Jersey did this, and that is affecting legislation now. But I think you're seeing, and if you notice the New York City Democratic primaries last night, we're continuing this big progressive or liberal swing in New York State politics. And this is the kind of thing that that the progressives have wanted for quite a while.
And the Democrats are in control across all three states, New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. It'll be interesting to see how they move forward, possibly together in the future. Michael Gormley, Newsday. Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Now, this one may catch a number of you by surprise, especially after years of health officials encouraging the use of condoms to try and prevent the spread of HIV. Now, according to reports, the number of reported STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, continues to go up. It's happening across the country. Connecticut is no exception. Shay Ingersoll is with us, a disease intervention specialist for the Connecticut Department of Public Health, and Dr. Lynn Sosa, who is the TB STD Control Programs Coordinator and Deputy State Epidemiologist for the Connecticut Department of Public Health. Welcome both. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Ron.
Dr. Sosa, when we're talking STDs, what are we talking about?
Right. So the primary STDs that we are talking about are chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and HIV. So there are many more sexually transmitted diseases, but those are the diseases that are reportable to us at the State Health Department. So what that means is that if a laboratory has a positive test for any of those diseases, or if a clinician or healthcare provider diagnoses and treats a patient with any of those diseases, they are required by law to report that to us at the State Health Department.
So, Dr. Sosa, what are the numbers telling you?
So, as you mentioned, Ron, and as CDC has pointed out, we are seeing really all-time highs. CDC last year for 2017 for chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, we're seeing all-time five-year highs for all of these diseases, and that's obviously really concerning to all of us.
Shay, why is this happening?
This is happening because people need additional techniques on risk reduction when it comes to their sexual partners. They need a better understanding on the tools that they can use to try to prevent these diseases, like the use of condoms and use of testing often.
Hmm. And what age groups are seeing the increase? Is it specific?
So certainly when we're talking about chlamydia and gonorrhea, we're particularly concerned about people that are under age 25, and there's a couple of reasons for that. So first of all, that is the age group that is most affected by these diseases, but certainly we are seeing increases across the board in terms of sexually transmitted diseases. But in particular, in terms of the complications from chlamydia and gonorrhea, especially for women, it can result in infertility as well as long-term issues. And so that's really the group that we focus on. I will say that for syphilis, the age group is a little bit older, so the average age is more around 30. But again, all of these diseases can affect people at any age if they're engaging in sex.
Shay, is this a problem more for the cities, the suburbs, rural? Does it matter?
I think the rise in STDs is something that we're seeing across the state in general. Dr. Sosa can definitely lend more to the specific numbers as far as city versus rural.
Right. So I will say chlamydia happens everywhere. So it's prevalent. It's all over the states, all over the country. Gonorrhea for Connecticut is certainly a disease that we see more commonly in urban areas. But again, it can happen in any town. And then the same is true for syphilis. So I think the point here is that if you're having sex, you need to be tested for these STDs because you're at risk.
I read a quote in Time magazine, and I'm wondering if I could get your reaction to it. It said, "You can look and map STDs in any city, and you'll find some parts of town that have higher rates than others. A lot of it's along those gradients of economic disparity and other markers of societal marginalization." Is that accurate?
I think so. So definitely looking at what are the root causes for a lot of the diseases that we deal with here at the health department are really important. And so I think you're pointing out that one of the things that we are really concerned about are health disparities. And certainly STDs are really no exception because they do affect certainly younger people. So that's one health disparity. They do affect minorities, especially African Americans and Hispanics more than whites. And so that is something that we have to look at. And it's funny that you mentioned that because one of the projects that we're doing this year is trying to map our gonorrhea cases, again, with the goal of trying to understand what are the communities most affected so that we can develop the right prevention measures for those communities.
Are there any communities in the state that you can point to that say these have higher rates and we're concerned?
I wouldn't be able to point to specific, you know, cities or towns. Again, we're really focused on the groups that are affected. So again, for us, that's really adolescents and young people, especially under age 25. That is African Americans and Hispanics, and then it's also men who have sex with men.
There is more gender fluidity nowadays. Is that having an impact?
If it's necessarily gender fluidity per se, I think you might be getting at the fact that social norms have certainly changed in regards to sex. So people are having more partners, people are meeting partners in a different way. And so that is a situation where people might be meeting people that they might not have known different. And the social circles that they're meeting partners in are different. So I would say that is definitely and is certainly one of the factors that is affecting the increase in STDs that we're seeing.
Shay, does social media have a lot to do with this, a lot of the apps and how people meet nowadays?
The atmosphere has definitely changed as far as how people connect with others. We see a lot of people when we interview them saying that they're using different apps like Grindr, Adam for Adam, even basic social media apps like Facebook and Instagram they're using to meet new partners and having more sex with anonymous partners. So social media has definitely played a role in the increased number of partners.
Dr. Sosa, I remember just a few years back when the message was practice safe sex. What happened? That seems to have kind of disappeared. I know it's still out there, but I don't hear it with the same urgency. Is that the right word?
I think that we're trying to be certainly more open to what people are doing and the types of behaviors that they're engaging in and trying to really get to the people. So it's certainly still an important message that people need to be using condoms, that they need to be testing often. But we need to do better at making sure that we're getting the prevention measures and messages out to people. So, you know, if people are going to be having multiple partners and meeting people online or on an app, we need to make sure that we have the STD clinics out there, that they know where they can go to get tested, where they know they can go to get treated, because sometimes people might not be comfortable going to their regular doctor. So it's not really about judging lifestyle or judging behavior, but it's really about trying to meet people where they are.
It's still difficult, like you said, even if they've been going to that regular doctor for years, it's still something that I think some have trouble expressing themselves about. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. There's definitely still a stigma about STDs. And that is another barrier that we're trying to break down by trying to get to people where they are, whether it's going on the absence and making sure that people know where they can go to seek care, and making sure that people understand what the services are that the health department can offer, so that they know they're not alone and that we're here to help. So that is really important because that is still a big issue, and people don't want to talk about having an STD. And as a result, that means they might not get tested or treated themselves. That might mean that they're afraid to talk to their partners to get them tested and treated.
Shay, so how are you getting the word out nowadays? What programs do you have in place to try and inform everyone?
Well, we just actually launched our Leave It to Us campaign, which is a YouTube video and something that can be shared across any platform, really, that explains the role of the health department and the DIS, the disease intervention specialist, the ways in which we would contact people in the community to get them in for testing and treatment. So we're hoping that that's going to be a great representation of what it is that we do to get the word out about how we can assist people with getting more testing and treatment for sexually transmitted diseases.
Dr. Sosa, I was told that STDs, I was told this probably a year or two ago, that STDs were a problem for seniors and in certain nursing homes. While at the same time, I know some millennials have said that they won't use condoms at all. They don't see this as an issue. So it sounds from what you're saying that this problem cuts across all age groups.
Absolutely, it does. So I think you're absolutely right. We're seeing more STDs in older populations. So if people's spouses pass away or people get divorced, then it's definitely an opportunity for them to meet new partners. And just because you're a certain age doesn't mean that you're not having sex. And so absolutely, you know, trying to get the message out to older people in addition to millennials and younger people. It's really an issue for all ages, and people have to know how to protect themselves. So that's using condoms, but also knowing, you know, where to get tested and treated and being willing to have those conversations. And again, as Shay said, with the Leave It to Us campaign, going out and talking to people's partners about potentially being exposed to an STD, that's something we've been doing a long time, but we're trying to do a better job with this video of making sure people know that the service is available and that we're here to help.
And Shay, I'm assuming that you know the demographics as well as anybody. This region simply is getting older, so reaching that older population must be one of your top priorities.
Absolutely. We prioritize everyone. We want to make sure that everyone is healthy and everyone is informed on where they can be tested and treated. But we also try to assist with any population that may have barriers to care, whether that's providing them transportation to the doctor or even as simple as showing them where to locate referrals for the testing and treatment that they may need.
Dr. Sosa, what are some of the misconceptions, if you will, about STDs?
Well, I think there's many misconceptions about STDs, but I think part of it, as you mentioned, is that if you're a certain age, you might not be exposed to it, that they're not a big deal. So all of these STDs that I mentioned to you, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, they're all curable, which is great, but people might not be aware of the complications that can result if you wait for a long period without them being diagnosed. So I think for some people, it's not a big deal, you know. And the other thing is that people might think that they have to have symptoms to have an STD. And unfortunately, all of these STDs are ones where your symptoms might be minimal or non-existent, but you still are infected, you can still get complications, and you can still pass them to your partners. And so that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions.
So if I can understand this right, can you have an STD and not know it?
Absolutely, yes, you can.
And how long can you have it? And there are no symptoms? There are no signs?
Right, exactly. So, you know, these are bacteria and viruses that have kind of coexisted with humans for a long time. And so it's certainly possible, and a certain percentage of people will have either very few symptoms or no symptoms at all. And so that's why it's so important that if people are having sex, that they get tested regularly so that they know as soon as they might have that infection to make sure that they're treated and then they don't pass it to their partners.
And this is what, a blood test?
So it depends on the STD. So for chlamydia and gonorrhea, it's usually either you can pee in a cup or you get a swab. It all depends on what kind of sex you're engaging in. For syphilis and HIV, it is a blood test.
Shay, how do you get past the embarrassment that some people may have just for simply going to get a test?
Absolutely. Like Dr. Sosa stated, there's still a lot of stigma related to sexually transmitted diseases and testing in general. We do want to always encourage routine testing. So we just try to normalize it. We try to talk about it as often as possible. When we speak to different patients and different people in the community, we always just mention testing as a part of your normal health practices, the same way that you would go and get a physical, the same way that you would get any other routine health services. Testing for sexually transmitted diseases should be included in those routine practices.
I'm assuming that both of you probably would want teens to know about this, to get the information out there. Does education need to start even earlier than that, Dr. Sosa?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's pretty much something that has to start once those conversations about sex start. Because, again, there should be no assumptions that, you know, people are a certain age before they have sex. I'm certainly aware of middle schools that have these conversations, some that even have these services available. And I think that's really an important part of normalizing the conversation so that we can break down the stigma so that just getting a test for STD doesn't mean that you're a bad person or that you've done anything wrong. It means that you're trying to stay healthy.
But Shay, I can see where some parents may be upset by this or certain groups. Is there always that fear of a backlash?
There is definitely some apprehension from parents, but the same way that we use the language of, you know, sex and sex testing, sexually transmitted testing and treatment being something that's a part of your routine health practices, that's also something that we try to communicate with parents. Getting your children informed is going to be way more useful than kind of not speaking about the topic. So the more that the parents inform the children, the more that they're aware of the healthy behaviors that they can use to try to prevent STDs and, if needed, treat them.
Dr. Sosa, I have to say that, you know, I could think back 40, 50 years ago and the conversations back then, which are very similar to the ones that we're having today. It was difficult, especially for those of us who were brought up in a religious school, a religious environment. At that time, it was, don't even talk about these things. Let's not acknowledge them.
Right. And certainly that still exists today. That's still part of the stigma, not wanting to have the conversations or being embarrassed about the conversations. So that's why that's part of our job, is making sure that people have the education, whether it's on our website or going to CDC's website or knowing where to go and get tested and treated, wanting to make sure that people know what their resources are. And that's really an important part of the conversation.
Shay, can I ask you about the funding for all of this? Because obviously you're doing important work and it needs money to get that word out there. Is the funding coming from the state to accomplish your goals?
That's a great question for Dr. Sosa.
Yes. So our funding for STD prevention is multifactorial. So certainly there is some from the state, but also from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So we do have a grant, and every state has a grant from CDC that is focused primarily on STD prevention and all of the services and strategies that go into that, as well as collecting the data so that we can understand and monitor the trends related to STDs.
So it sounds from what you're saying that you get some money from the state and some from the feds.
Exactly, right.
We have about a minute or so left. What haven't I asked that you would like to get out, the information that you would like to get out to the public about STDs and obviously what you're doing?
One thing that we want people to know is that when you do test positive for an STD, such as chlamydia, gonorrhea, or syphilis, it is something that is going to be reported to the state health department by law, and that's where the disease intervention specialist comes in. We are going to contact you and try to provide you with some assistance. If you haven't already been treated, we definitely want to get you treated. And if you haven't already had that conversation with your partners, which can be a hard one, we want to assist you with that. So it's always something that's confidential. It's a free service. We just want people to know that partner services exist, and it's not something that they have to be afraid to use. In order to keep everyone healthy and reduce transmission of sexually transmitted diseases, we absolutely want to provide testing and treatment to all the partners that we can. So we just want people to know that we're here and we're here to help.
I guess that goes back to what you were saying before, that the fear, but also you want to stress that the information is being kept confidential. No one else is
Absolutely.
Going to get this information.
Absolutely.
And where, if someone is listening and if they want to go someplace to get more information about this, what's the best thing to do?
So the best thing to do is to go to our website, which is portal.ct.gov/DPH, and then they can find the STD program and our all of the resources there, including our video, which is hashtag Leave It To Us, about partner services.
Dr. Lynn Sosa is the TB STD Control Programs Coordinator and Deputy State Epidemiologist for the Connecticut Department of Public Health, and Shay Ingersoll is a Disease Intervention Specialist for the Connecticut Department of Public Health. Thank you both. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Now, we're going to turn our attention to a study which concerns Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, and cancer care. We're going to bring in Blythe Adamson, a researcher at Flatiron Health, which is a New York tech startup. Blythe Adamson is the study's lead author. And Blythe, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Ron.
We appreciate your time. I should mention are you joining us on Skype? Yes, you are. Thank you for that. Give us some background. Last year, you were brainstorming. You came up with an idea. And what was it?
Well, we really wanted to test whether or not the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansions improved timely treatment of advanced cancers. And we had this hypothesis we wanted to test that Medicaid expansion would reduce the racial disparities that we've been seeing nationwide of Black patients being treated, taking longer to be treated for advanced cancer than white patients. So that's the hypothesis that we wanted to test.
And this just kind of came to you out of the blue?
Well, it's actually similarly related to what Dr. Sosa was talking about previously with STDs and CDC surveillance. Before coming to Flatiron to work on cancer, I had been working in HIV and using some of that CDC data that her team and others around the country are making available to do this type of analysis and see whether or not Medicaid expansion was making a difference. But the problem that I faced and that many other researchers like me faced was there wasn't enough recency in the data. So usually government data sets or other health data we have is years old. Hmm. You know, it can be 3 or 4 years old by the time we can get our hands on it to do research. And if it takes us a year to do the analysis and a few years to publish, by the time it's, out there for people to learn about, it can be sometimes, 6 to 8 years old, which is just too stale to be policy relevant. And so when I came to Flatiron and saw that the recency of learning from electronic health records that are de-identified was within 30 days, I knew that we had an opportunity that no one else had to learn from the experiences of patients to do real-time policy evaluation.
I'm sorry, let me clarify. So you're saying that the information that you're working with is less or just about a month old?
Yes, exactly. What we presented June 2nd at the American Society for Clinical Oncology was learning from the experience of cancer patients treated as recent as February 28th, 2019.
That's amazing.
It is. I think, it's important that we keep up with the field because new medicines are coming out all the time. And, data that's 3 or 4 years old is, it's really hard to learn from because things are changing so quickly over time.
Okay, so let's run through what you found, and then maybe we could talk about the methodology that you put into this. What were the results of this?
We found that without Medicaid expansion, that white patients were more likely to receive timely treatment. And we define that as from an advanced cancer diagnosis. And we looked at 8 different advanced or metastatic cancer types that if they were treated within 30 days, we called that, timely treatment. That white patients were getting treated 48.3% of the time and Black patients only 43.5. So there's about a 5 percentage point difference which was a racial disparity. And then with Medicaid expansion, that difference in timely treatment between white and Black patients was reduced to less than 1 percentage point and became statistically insignificant. So, in effect, really, we found that Medicaid expansion was associated with practically eliminating racial disparities in timely treatment of advanced cancer.
That's an amazing drop. I use that word amazing, but it is how much it dropped within a short period of time.
Well, the Affordable Care Act was implemented in January of 2014. And so we had follow-up data from 2014 all the way through February of 2019. And often it can take a long time to pick up these effects. And it's quite a challenge to understand the effect of a policy when different states are implementing and adopting it at different times. Mm. You know, not everyone, not all of the states, you know, January 1 of 2014 decided to adopt. There were still a lot of uncertainty about what to do, and states are still making decisions about whether to adopt or implement or even repeal Medicaid expansion.
So these numbers that you crunched, the data, they came in from all 50 states?
We use data from 39 states that Flatiron Health has clinics or academic medical centers, at least one within 39 states. And we had a good mix of, geographic variation and a good mix of ones that had expanded and never expanded Medicaid.
You know what? I guess this would be the right time just to clarify a little bit. What does your company do? What does the business do? Flatiron Health.
Yeah. So we are a health tech company that is learning from the experience of every cancer patient to improve cancer patients' lives. And we develop software that is an electronic health record software used in community oncology clinics every day with patients and physicians. And we also partner with academics and curate the data to use it from research and learn from patients in real time.
I'm listening to this and it sounds like a wonderful corporation, a wonderful company, but at the same time, I'm thinking, how come the government isn't doing this?
Well, we have seen the government do this, for example, in the last example that Dr. Sosa was giving with the CDC, where, you know, there are federal mandates for surveillance. And that really is of particular diseases. We do have some national cancer data sets available to us to learn from, such as SEER. But really what, as a researcher, we had been lacking before was something that had the breadth. So a huge number of cancer patients, and Flatiron Health has data from more than 2 million cancer patients. But you also need the depth. You can't just take, you know, surface level features of these patients and compare how well one drug works to another drug and what might be the best treatment for this patient if you only have things on the surface. You know, we have to curate these things with a lot of expertise and clinical knowledge to understand, you know, what stage was this patient when they first were diagnosed? Why are there gaps in this treatment history to understand the nuances and the test results that have come back to understand these cancer patients' journeys, to be able to learn from them and be able to help patients in the future.
And just to be clear about this, I believe before that you said that there were no identifying markers as to the information that you were receiving, the data, so you don't know who the patients are, their names, whatever?
Yes. So part of the curation process is de-identification. And so the data that we use, and we partnered with Yale in this study with, you know, two amazing outcomes researchers, Amy Davidoff and Carrie Gross at Yale. The data sets that we use were completely de-identified. So, you know, we understand things like the patient's age and, you know, stage of diagnosis, when they first started treatment and what drugs they used and what their lab reports were. But to protect patients' privacy and remain compliant with HIPAA, as we do as researcher, you know, I've done as a researcher here at Flatiron and in other settings, we learn in a de-identified setting.
I asked that because the other day we had a program on privacy and the internet and what goes on nowadays with marketers. And I'm assuming that some are listening to this saying, you know, I don't want my medical information out there. But again, just to be clear, you're saying that there are no identifying markers. Do the patients opt into this? Can they opt out of it if they don't want that information out there?
Exactly. Patients can opt out of this. It's an option, available to all patients.
And that's, I've been through this before. When you go in and they give you a number of documents and they say, sign these, don't sign these, this will explain all your the patient's rights.
Exactly. Patients have rights and their medical data belongs to them, and they can choose at any time to opt out, not just at the first visit.
Okay, Blythe, I know your study takes a look at white Americans, African Americans. Are you going to expand it to other groups in the future?
Yes, we could. One of the things I'm really excited to promote with this type of research is partnerships and open source coding. And there are seven large academic medical centers, universities, cancer centers that in their partnerships with Flatiron Health have free access to all of our data. And so I'm really excited to make all of the analysis code that was written for this study available to those researchers with the protocol that we used, because we can, exponentially build upon this by having other disparities researchers replicate this, extend it, look at other outcomes. There are many other meaningful outcomes for cancer patients than just how soon they can be treated. And I'm looking forward to working with more investigators as they extend this and look at other outcomes.
Have you heard, your study is pretty amazing. The results are encouraging, to say the least. Have you heard from other, from doctors, researchers, or maybe even politicians?
Yes. We've had quite a big response to this. It was presented at the biggest cancer meeting in the world as the number one talk on the main stage. And, with 40,000 cancer docs all watching this together and in the audience, and this beautiful discussion of it after the main talk by Dr. Yusuf Zafar from Duke, there were thousands of doctors in the audience crying. The results are very meaningful to physicians and have also had a really big impact in reaching an opportunity to reach politicians through social media. So the stories that have been written about this study have been shared on social media more than 20,000 times. And that includes many senators and congressional representatives and people who even served on the Obama administration at the time that Obamacare was being implemented. So it's just been an incredible honor to lead a team of researchers who started working on this in November and December to present results in June, learning from cancer patients so recently, and be able to effectively reach policymakers, within, 6 months, a 6 month period, is just a really incredible privilege.
Now that you have the results, what are you thinking nowadays about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare?
Well, the Affordable Care Act had three main goals: to improve the access to healthcare, the quality, and the equity. This study specifically looked at equity to find out, in this one disease, in cancer, in this one outcome, timely treatment, did it reach its goal of improving equity? And we found out in this case that it did. And, I hope that the data speaks for itself and people can draw their own conclusions about what they think may happen to equity in cancer care if Medicaid expansion or the ACA were repealed.
So where do you go from here? What can we expect to hear from you in the next year or so?
Oh, well, we have a lot of new ideas going with the next project I'm working on is learning about some of these really incredible immunotherapy cancer drugs in people who are living with HIV and cancer, who have always been historically excluded from participating in clinical trials because of their HIV status. So that's a hack that we've been putting together and look forward to sharing the results of that soon.
And in terms of this study, if you do expand it to other groups, when can we expect to see the results of that?
Ooh, I think we'll just have to wait and see. We're gonna put out the paper for this one soon to give the scientific community an opportunity to fully vet the work that we've done, the methods, the sensitivity analyses, And, you know, I think there'll be a lot of things to learn from and ways that we can improve and strengthen the approach that we're using to figure out, you know, if this causes that, if Medicaid expansion really is improving equity in cancer and in other outcomes.
Blythe Adamson, researcher at Flatiron Health, New York tech startup. Blythe Adamson is the study's lead author. It was a pleasure. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Ron.
Take care. If you'd like to comment on today's program, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. Find us on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU, or you can even leave us a voicemail. We're at 833-CALL-TFS. That number comes out to 833-225-5837. That'll do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, and Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.